Welcome to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. In this hour, what does the leftist turn in Latin American elections mean for the region and for the politics of these nations? But first, the Supreme Court is handing down its rulings from this year's docket. What has the court decided and what impact will it play in American politics? We recorded this segment on June 22nd. Since then, the court has issued several rulings in cases, including New York State Rifle versus Bruin on gun control. The new conservative supermajority on the U.S. Supreme Court was expected to shift the court's decisions to the right in this term. They've taken on a number of issues, indicating a willingness to challenge some of the more significant precedents in American law. While two of the most high-profile cases have yet to be released, there have been others that have borne out this prediction of a rightward shift. On today's show, we will explore some of these decisions and what it means for the future of American law and politics. Our guest is Erwin Chemerinsky. He's the Dean and Jesse H. Choper Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law. He has many publications, and they include The Religious Clauses, The Case for Separating Church and State with Howard Gilman, and most recently, Presumed Guilty, How the Supreme Court Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights. Professor Chemerinsky, thank you so much for joining us. Let's just delve right into the cases. One of them that was released, I believe, this week was a case called Carson versus Macon, and that deals with the issue of separation of church and state. What exactly was decided, and what's the significance of the decision?
It's great to be with you. Carson versus Macon involves the state of Maine. There are areas there that are too rural to support a public school system. So school administrative units give money to parents to send their children to private school. Maine law says that money has to be used in secular private schools. It can't be used in religious schools. Two families brought a challenge to this. The Supreme Court ruled 6-3, divided along ideological lines, that to deny the use of the funds in religious schools violated free exercise of religion. Chief Justice Roberts wrote for the court. Both Justice Breyer and Sotomayor wrote dissents, joined by Justice Kagan.
Now, on this case, how limited is the case? Because it seems like there were some specifics here about these were rural families, they didn't have easy access to public schools. Was it a pretty limited case, or is it pretty sweeping?
I think the implications are sweeping. I think the Supreme Court is saying whenever the government provides financial support for private secular schools, it must provide the support for religious schools. I think this is going to go beyond just private schools, and it's going beyond schools. So many cities across the country have charter schools funded by the public school system. Up till now, such as in California, the law has been that the charter schools must be secular. I am sure now that religious organizations that want to create charter schools will say to deny them funding violates free exercise of religion. Or think about instances where the government provides money for historic preservation of buildings or money for drug and alcohol rehabilitation programs. To the extent the government has refused to provide those funds for churches, synagogues, mosques, I think this means that's likely unconstitutional.
So it seems there's two big sweeping issues. One is the wall between church and state seems to be coming down. And second, related to that, this really seems to set the stage to legalize, perhaps even mandate questions of school choice. Is that fair?
Yes, to both. It's interesting that the Supreme Court, in its opinion in Carson's Macon, pays no attention to the Establishment Clause and the wall that separates church and state. Until very recently, the Supreme Court had said the government is limited by the Establishment Clause and the aid that it can give to religious schools. We've now gone from the question of when may the government give aid without violating the Establishment Clause to when must the government give aid so as to not violate free exercise of religion. The court has obliterated the notion of a wall that separates church and state. Once the government is subsidizing parochial schools, there is no wall that separates church and state. And in terms of essentially constitutionalizing school choice, I think that's where the court is going. It's not that long ago that the issue was, may the government, if it chooses, provide vouchers that can be used in religious schools. Now it's the government must provide vouchers for religious schools if it's providing them for secular education.
Yeah, that actually is quite striking. On another case, my understanding, this case was actually decided a number of months ago, the sort of COVID-related cases, the so-called OSHA cases. My understanding, again, that was the Biden administration trying to use OSHA regulations to require a vaccine mandate. What was the court's findings in that case?
It's important to note that the cases were not about the constitutionality of vaccine mandates. They were about whether or not two federal agencies had statutory authority to require vaccinations. And the court came out in a split way. The first case was National Federation of Business versus Department of Labor, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and it involved an emergency temporary standard by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration that for all places of employment, over 100 workers, the employees either had to be vaccinated or tested weekly. The Supreme Court ruled 6-3, split along ideological lines, that the Occupational Safety and Health Administration lacked the authority to require this. It applied to about 84 million American workers. The second case that came down the same day was Biden versus Missouri. It involved the Department of Health and Human Services that required that all recipients of federal Medicare and Medicaid money have their employees be vaccinated. It applied to about 10 million workers in the United States. And the Supreme Court 5-4 upheld that as within the statutory authority of the Department of Health and Human Services. Roberts and Kavanaugh, who were in the majority in the first case, joined the dissenters in the first case, Brierson and Kagan, to create the majority. It was hard to read the cases and believe they came down the same day from the same court. In the OSHA case, the court talked about the unprecedented scope of the regulation and never acknowledged the dangers of COVID. In the second case, they talked about the unprecedented dangers of COVID. And at that point, almost 80 million people had died now, or 800,000 people had died. Now it's over 1 million people who have died from COVID. The statutory authority for the Occupational Safety and Health Administration is even clearer than the statutory authority for Health and Human Services. What's the difference? Well, maybe it's that one involved 84 million workers and the other involved 10 million workers. Or as one of my students said, maybe it's that the justices can't imagine working in a poultry plant, but they can imagine going for medical care and want the people who treat them to be vaccinated.
Yeah, that's actually, you know, then quite striking. Does it matter then as well? Is there a distinction between public and private actors at this point where, I mean, the OSHA case seems to deal with a bit more public, or am I reading that incorrectly?
Both cases were regulation of private workers. The OSHA case said any employer with over 100 employees had to have them vaccinated or tested. The latter case said that any facility that received Medicare or Medicaid funds, and these are generally private facilities, had to have its workers vaccinated. There have been a lot of cases in the lower courts that involve mandates for public employees to be vaccinated or students at public universities or public schools to be vaccinated. Interestingly, those cases have almost without exception upheld the vaccine mandates as constitutional. The only place where there's been disagreement is whether there has to be a religious exception to the vaccine mandate.
Now, you mentioned lower courts. One of the lower court decisions that hasn't made its way but could have some pretty significant implications was the decision of a federal judge to overturn the mask mandates for travel, you know, for the airlines. Has anything developed from that? And what's at stake with that decision?
It's important to note that it was a very conservative judge, an appointee of Donald Trump, and on reasoning that to me is quite specious. The federal government through the Public Health Act has very broad authority to take actions to stop the spread of a communicable disease in interstate commerce. And of course, that's what the mask mandate is about. But the judge interprets the statute as just being about, quote, sanitation, narrowly defined. But the ruling had immediate effects. Literally, when the ruling was announced, pilots in the air said to their passengers, you don't have to wear your masks anymore. The ruling's on appeal to the 11th Circuit, and there's a lot at stake because it really is about the authority for the Center for Disease Control to help protect us from communicable diseases. This isn't going to be the last pandemic or threatened pandemic. CDC needs to have the authority to do what's necessary to protect public health. And if this judge's ruling stands, CDC's authority is very limited.
There also seemed to be a procedural development here as well. I know usually this is associated with the Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch, this notion of textualism and the specific definitions of words. That decision, I know some of the critique was a fairly bizarre interpretation, you know, of the word sanitation. How much of a concern is that, that it seems that a number of the rulings have to do with a judge's specific interpretation of a word, even at times where there may be a precedent where the word has meant something different, but it's interpreted by this judge differently?
Judicial decisions are so often about interpreting words, interpreting the words of the Constitution, interpreting the words of statutes. I think in this instance, the judge adopted remarkably limited, I'd even say perverse interpretation of the authority of the Center for Disease Control.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing decisions of the Supreme Court on this year's docket with Erwin Chemerinsky of the University of California, Berkeley School of Law. Another decision of the court, the Egbert decision, has to do with questions about government liability, correct? What exactly was that case about and what was decided?
Is this Egbert versus Bully?
Yes.
Okay. There's a federal statute that says that state and local government officers who violate the Constitution can be sued for money damages. There's not a federal statute that authorizes suits against federal government officials who violate the Constitution. But in 1971, the Supreme Court in Bivens versus six unknown named agents at the Federal Bureau of Narcotics said that a federal officer who violates the Constitution can be sued for money damages. The court said you can infer the cause of action right from the constitutional provision. Bivens involved an individual, Webster Bivens, who was subjected to an abusive, illegal, unconstitutional search by agents of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. And the Supreme Court said his rights are violated. He can sue. Well, unfortunately, the Supreme Court has time and again since 1980 made it difficult to sue federal officers and narrow the availability of Bivens suits. Egbert versus Bully is the most recent example. What it involves is a situation where a man, Bully, owns an inn right near the Washington-Canadian border in Blaine, Washington. Perhaps inadvisedly, he decided to call his business the Smuggler's Inn. A immigration official, a border agent, by the name of Egbert, followed someone from the Blaine Airport to the Smuggler's Inn. And Egbert wanted to question this person. Bully said, "Leave my guest alone." Egbert pushed Bully out of the way. Ultimately, Egbert let the person stay at the inn. There's no problem. Well, Bully filed a complaint against Egbert with the Border Patrol, saying that he had been treated abusively and illegally. Egbert retaliated by going to the Washington State Licensing Board and saying that Egbert was violating the law and going to the IRS and saying they should investigate Egbert. They did. It cost Egbert a lot of money. Ultimately, he was exonerated. So Egbert sues Bully for violating his Fourth Amendment rights with an illegal seizure, excessive police force, and for retaliation against him, response to the complaints he filed. The Supreme Court ruled 6-3 that Bully could not sue Egbert, that no Bivens suit was available in this context. No Bivens suit is available under the Fourth Amendment against border agents. No Bivens suit is available for retaliation claims. It was again the court closing the courthouse door in really limiting the ability to sue federal officials who violate the Constitution.
So in keeping with these border questions, there seems to be three cases. Two have been decided, the third hasn't yet been decided, that seems to indicate that the court is telling legislatures that they're not going to be able to take action on some real core political issues. And I think, you know, those issues, border policy, climate change, and gun control. Let's start with the border policy one. This is Biden versus Texas. And it seems that the court is indicating to the Biden administration that they have no choice but to maintain a policy, the previous president's policy on the border, despite a clear stated preference on the part of the administration to want to change that policy. Is that a pretty accurate ruling?
This is a case that has not come down as of our conversation on June 22nd. And I think it's important to note the court hasn't yet decided. This involves the so-called return to Mexico policy. And the question basically is whether or not a person has to seek amnesty in a country they're going through before they can come to the United States and seek amnesty. And the Trump administration said yes. The Biden administration reversed the policy. And Texas sued and said the Biden administration acted inappropriately. The underlying question is, when can a new administration rescind the policies of the prior administration? We saw it with regard to DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival. The Trump administration rescinded the Obama administration policy, but the Supreme Court 5-4 said it didn't follow proper procedures. The issue here is, did the Biden administration follow proper procedures?
So that has a distinct possibility, and of course it hasn't been handed down, that it could be much less the broad question of whether you can change the policy and really much more the way in which you change the policy. Is that correct?
I think that's right.
Has the West Virginia versus EPA, has that been handed down yet?
Again, as of June 22nd, it hasn't been. This is a complicated case, but one that could have enormous significance. The Obama administration adopted the Clean Power Plan to limit greenhouse gas emissions from power plants, a significant source of the problem of climate change. The Trump administration rescinded the Clean Power Plan. It created its own affordable clean energy plan that was far more permissive with regard to greenhouse gas emissions. A lawsuit was brought saying the Trump administration did not follow proper procedures. The DC Circuit agreed that the Trump administration didn't follow proper procedures in rescinding the Obama-era policy. West Virginia and some coal companies have sought Supreme Court review. Now, maybe this will just be about what are the procedures when one administration repeals the policies of another. Or maybe this will be much more about the scope of the EPA to deal with greenhouse gas emissions. Or maybe this will be the case where the Supreme Court imposes very significant limits on what administrative agencies can do. I think this is a case that shouldn't be before the Supreme Court. The Affordable Clean Energy Plan isn't being implemented by the Biden administration. The Clean Power Plan isn't being implemented by the Biden administration. There is no case or controversy before the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court seems quite inclined to decide this issue.
Is it fair to say then they took that on because they actually do want to make a ruling on a much broader issue than the one that specifically is before them?
We'll see. They could do anything in this case from dismiss on the grounds that there's really no case or controversy to using this as the case to dramatically limit the power of administrative agencies in the environmental area and all areas.
That raises then a broad question. The first of the two questions I have then is, are you noting a trend on the decisions? Is there any broad lessons about this year's docket that this new supermajority court is signaling the directions where they're going?
The justices are following conservative political ideology. They're following the Republican platform. This isn't about following precedent. The court's likely to overrule Roe versus Wade. This isn't about deferring to the political process. The court didn't defer to Maine and its political process with regard to not wanting to subsidize parochial schools. It's not likely to defer to New York in regulating guns. This isn't about originalism. The court in saying that Maine had to subsidize parochial schools certainly wasn't following the original intent of the framers. James Madison thought it was abhorrent to force people to be taxed to support the religion of others. This is a conservative court that's understood only that it's following the conservative political platform.
And so I always hear, particularly from the Heritage Foundation, that conservative approach to the law is a process oriented, not a results oriented process. I take it you would challenge that assertion.
It's nonsense. Think about the substance of the Republican platform: against abortion rights, against gun control, in favor of subsidies of religious education, against regulation with regard to climate change. That's what these decisions are about. They're not about process. They're about the conservative justices wanting to come to conservative substantive outcomes.
So the last question, obviously, we've been talking about cases that haven't been handed down. The gun control case, the New York State Rifle Association versus Bruin, and then obviously the Dobbs decision have also not been handed down. There's been a lot of different interpretations as to why this late in June, so we're recording on June the 22nd, that there's so many of these key decisions that haven't been handed down, different speculation. I guess, first of all, is this unprecedented or is it fairly consistent that we'd be this late into June and still have so many decisions that are outstanding?
Of course, there are things that have been unprecedented this year. The leak of the draft opinion by Justice Alito and Dobbs is unprecedented. But in terms of the calendar, the court was a bit slower getting into June and releasing decisions than in prior years, but not extraordinarily so. And they've released a lot of decisions in the last 2 weeks. I think they have about 11 cases to go in June and about 10 days, basically. That's where they are every year. I remember one year they had 6 or 7 cases that came down just on the last day of the term. So yes, they may have been a little slower, but they've made up for it now.
How much then are the protests that we're seeing? I mean, since the leak of the Dobbs opinion, there have been protests. There's been a great deal of conversation about the need to extend Secret Service protections to justices. There was the case of the individual who had apparently planned to try to assassinate Justice Kavanaugh. What kind of impact could this be having on the court, or is this just completely speculative?
A Gallup poll in the fall showed that the Supreme Court had its lowest approval ratings in history. It was a 40% approval rating and a 53% disapproval. That's unprecedented. I think if the court overrules Roe, as I expect it will, it's going to take a further hit on the court's legitimacy. People are very angry. Obviously, it's inexcusable to threaten a justice, and the man who was arrested should be prosecuted. And I disapprove of demonstrations outside the justices' homes. But the only thing I'd say is I think it reflects great anger at the Supreme Court being about to take away the right to abortion and putting other rights in jeopardy.
And by the way, I imagine if the gun control case coming out of New York is decided in the way that this majority, you know, has indicated, at a moment where we're debating some form of gun control legislation, that would probably also add to the challenge to the legitimacy of the court.
I agree. I think it's important to recognize that the American people ideologically are a little bit left of center, a little bit right of center, and we could argue about that. We have 5 justices very far right of center. And I think the crucial question in the weeks, the months, the years ahead is what will it mean to have a Supreme Court that's so politically out of touch with the majority of the American people? I saw a CNN poll that 2/3 of the American people don't want to see Roe versus Wade overruled. What will it mean for the court's legitimacy when it goes ahead and does that?
Some very important issues the court's going to be facing going forward. We've been discussing this year's docket and decisions from the Supreme Court with Erwin Chemerinsky. He's the Dean and Jesse H. Choper Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law. Of his many publications, they include the religion clauses, the case for separating church and state with Howard Gilman, and most recently, presumed guilty, how the Supreme Court empowered the police and subverted civil rights. Professor Chemerinsky, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, Latin America is turning to the left in its recent elections. What's causing this turn? Stay with us as we discuss the politics of Latin America. Welcome back to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. Is Latin America's leftist turn a reaction to neoliberalism or perhaps to perceptions of corruption in incumbent governments? We explore the so-called pink wave across Latin America. On June 19th, 2022, Colombia elected the leftist president for the first time in its history. Gustavo Petro, a former M19 guerrilla, won the election. His vice president, Francia Marquez Mina, is the first Black vice president in the nation's history. This election follows a trend of leftist democratic successes, including the election of Gabriel Boric in Chile, remarkable not just because of his leftist politics, but his youth. He was only 35 when elected. Other nations in the region have seen leftist candidates win their presidencies. These include Peru, Argentina, Honduras, Bolivia, and Mexico. And this fall, the region's largest nation, Brazil, goes to the polls in a likely matchup between its rather Trumpian president, Jair Bolsonaro, and a leftist former president, Luiz Inácio da Silva, or who is known as Lula. This trend has been nicknamed the Pink Wave, and it suggests political change in the region. On today's show, we explore the pink wave and what it means for politics and society throughout Latin America. Our guests are Benjamin Arditi, professor of politics at the National University of Mexico. He is the author of Politics on the Edges of Liberalism, Difference, Populism, Revolution, Agitation, and Arguments About the Left Turns in Latin America, a Post-Liberal Politics. Maxwell Cameron is professor of political science and public policy and global affairs at the University of British Columbia. He's the co-editor of Latin America's Left Turns, Politics, Policies, and Trajectories of Change, and author of The Return of Oligarchy, Threats to Representative Democracy in Latin America. And Marcia Ribeiro Diaz is adjunct professor and researcher in political science at the Federal University of the State of Rio de Janeiro. Her current research project is on disillusionment and the art of silence, a study on electoral abstention in Brazil, and co-author of Mutualism Between Liberal Conservatism and Fascism, Ideological Dispute and Political Scenario of Contemporary Brazil. Thank you all very much for joining us. Benjamin Arditi, I will start with you. Being, you know, in Mexico, Mexico kind of led this way with the election, you know, their current president. What seems to be driving this move to the left within the region?
Some people will disagree with you about being a move to the left in Mexico. Many people will call Andrés Manuel, the president of Mexico, a conservative, social conservative at least. The reasons are going to be different in many countries, but there is a common thread, at least as far as I know. And the three words that I use to describe this are frustration, dignity, empowerment. And this frustration with impunity and corruption of the ruling classes for the last 30, 40 years, the disillusionment with the adjustment policies that promises welfare for most people, but we ended up with a fantastic rate of growth, but very poor distribution of income. And there is also an effort of empowerment for people that are excluded because they're Black, they're young, they're women, they're indigenous. So after, what is it, 40 years of this experiment of neoliberal adjustment policies, something seems to be moving and people seem to be fed up. If you think about Chile, why did a 35-year-old ex-student activist win the elections? I cannot know exactly why he won the elections, but one thing I do pay a lot of attention is the cultural element and the social component of the protests of 2019. You have a Chile is a poster child for the adjustment policies in Latin America before democracy and during democracy. If you look at the composition of the protesters in 2011, it was middle-class students, including the current president. The protest in 2019 is different. It comes from people in the poblaciones, which is the lower classes, neighborhoods around Santiago, near the airport and other sections of Santiago. And the song that became the anthem of the protesters is a song by a group called The Prisoners, Los Prisioneros. That was a song of 1986 called The Dance of the Leftovers. And it's a song that narrates life of somebody that did everything that was asked from them. They indebted themselves to go to college. They looked for jobs. They could never improve. And they're left as the casualties of the adjustment policies. And as the song says, just walking around with dirt in my shoes and kicking stones. So you have this tremendous frustration of unfulfilled promises of democracy and the market.
And Maxwell Cameron, so we're seeing this at least in part as a reaction to globalization, which, I mean, broadly, this tends to fall under this rubric of populism. Is this largely a leftist populist movement?
That's an interesting way of framing it. I think I would say in the first instance that I'm not entirely sure that the idea of a pink tide or a wave is necessarily the best metaphor. I think what we're really confronting is that after three or four decades of more or less enduring democracy, the left has emerged and established itself as a major political force in the region. So if you think back, you know, much of the 20th century in most parts of Latin America, if you were an activist of the left, you had a target painted on your back. There was a good chance that you could be arrested, you could be tortured, you could be disappeared. And consequently, the left had very little influence. It rarely was able to take power or hold it for very long. A few exceptions, like in Chile and Guatemala, which of course ended with violence and coups. And so in other parts of the region, you mentioned populism. Latin America has a long history of populism. And in many instances, the left was actually marginalized by or co-opted or absorbed by populist movements. So for example, Peronism essentially put the left out of business in Argentina to such a degree that when there was a radical urban guerrilla movement in the 1970s, it was birthed by the Peronist Party. And to be on the left in Argentina today is essentially to be on the left of the Peronist Party. And so what we're seeing in Latin America today is the emergence of left-wing parties and movements and leaders that in many cases really reflect the peculiarities of the traditions of each of those countries. Now, with the end of the Cold War, Jorge Castaneda wrote a famous book called Utopia Unarmed, where he argued that the left would probably disappear. There would be no reason to have a left in Latin America after the end of communism. Everybody was embracing democracy, liberal democracy, and markets. And the left, if it wanted to survive, would have to do the same. It would have to become social democratic. And what we saw, as Ben has just suggested, is something very different. We saw the left emerging to challenge neoliberalism, often with a very radical, even revolutionary rhetoric, even though these were governments that were, in fact, democratically elected. And I think that in some of those instances, Venezuela in particular, the mentality on the part of the left was, we have an opportunity now to take power by democratic means. We need to seize that opportunity. We need to seize power and then use that position to transform society. And so in that kind of mentality, in that way of thinking, the notion of alternation in office was not a prominent feature. And so they tended to often behave very arrogantly with regard opposition forces. I think what's happening today, it's not as if there's now so much a second wave of the left, although, you know, I think as Ben has rightly noted, there have been across the region these movements of protests in Ecuador, in Chile, in Venezuela, in Brazil, many places that I think have brought about change. Often it's as much as anything a challenge to incumbents, it's frustration with incumbents. And so since there was a kind of a rise of more right-wing leaders with Bolsonaro, for example, with Macri, with Áñez in Bolivia, the current moment where incumbents are losing power is bringing the left back into office. But I think what's happening is it's no longer so much a wave as it is just sort of the normal politics in a region now that the left has effectively established itself as an enduring political force.
I think that's a really interesting point too, because a lot of these countries, the perception is these are kind of new leftist leaders that sort of come out of protest movements, et cetera. But Marcia Diaz, in Brazil, there's probably no figure more sort of entrenched, more well-known in Brazilian politics than Lula. So how much is this upcoming election seen as a referendum on Lula's sort of previous leftist politics, or is it really just about anger with the current president?
As we know, the possibility of re-election in presidential systems tends to favor the incumbent. However, here in Brazil, our political situation does not favor the re-election of Jair Bolsonaro at this time. The far-right president made a terrible government in every way. So it's a kind of referendum of this government. From the first moment, Bolsonaro adopted a conflictive posture with different segments of society in Brazil, the press and the journalists in general, environmental defense organizations. And he frequently confronted the most important progressive values. In addition, the poor management of the health area during the pandemic of COVID-19, the delay in acquiring vaccines in 2021 led to the death of almost 700 people in the country. So, on the other hand of this scenario, voters have the memory of the conditions of social well-being promoted during the governments of former President Lula, his government in Brazil since 2003 until 2010. Lula regained recently his political rights back, and he's at this time the favorite candidate in the 2022 election, presidential election, after more than 500 days in an unfair imprisonment. If current conditions are maintained, Lula could still be elected at the first round of elections. To make Bolsonaro's situation worse, earlier this month, the disappearance and subsequent realization of the death of Brazilian indigenist Bruno Pereira and English journalist Don Phillips showed the government lack of control over the Amazon territory. Event further shook the already worn out international image of Bolsonaro government. And this week, the former Minister of Education of Bolsonaro government and some Presbyterian pastors linked to the president were arrested in a major corruption scandal involving the allocation of ministry funds to allies of president to favor his re-election. The articulation of the campaign of the re-election of Bolsonaro was structured on a myth of a government without corruption that is no longer sustainable. So what we have at this moment, we have the election at this moment, probably Bolsonaro can't re-election and Lula will be back to the front of government. He has a public image much better internationally of the point of view internationally, better, much better than Bolsonaro. And at this moment, we believe that the situation of unemployment, inflation, there is a perception, a general perception that it should be better with a new government, with this new election.
Absolutely. You listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about the recent left-wing party successes throughout Latin America with Benjamin Arditi of the National University of Mexico, with Maxwell Cameron of the University of British Columbia, and Marcia Ribeiro Diaz of the State University of Rio de Janeiro. So Maxwell Cameron, Marcia raised some interesting questions broadly about corruption, because I know in the region, there was a tendency for rightist candidates to use corruption to try to attack leftist candidates. Certainly an anti-incumbent, corruption is a very popular theme in the anti-incumbent sentiment. How much is corruption playing a role in perception? We need a government that's just more responsive to the needs of the population.
I think corruption is just a hugely important issue in the region. We've, of course, seen a mega scandal of corruption around the Odebrecht company in Brazil, which was involved in bribery and kickback schemes right across the region that actually destabilized several governments and have resulted in investigations and imprisonment of former government officials. The country that I know best, Peru, many of the former presidents were implicated in corruption around Odebrecht. And of course, you know, Odebrecht, you know, pursued its corrupt practices under a variety of different governments, both in Brazil and outside. But certainly there was a perception of uncontrolled corruption under the government of Lula and Dilma in Brazil that resulted in major opposition. But the fact of the matter is that corruption is endemic in the region as a consequence of the patrimonial nature of public or state institutions. And so it's very hard to avoid corruption in politics in the region. It has tarnished governments of both the left and the right. And it speaks to the need to strengthen the integrity of public institutions. I think it cuts both ways. Corruption can also facilitate candidates, outsider candidates often of the left, that take advantage. I mean, I think what Marcia was just saying about the corruption being exposed in the Bolsonaro government will favor Lula. The reality is that corruption is a problem right across the board. I'm not sure that any, either the left or the right, have a particular sort of monopoly on the issue.
And Benjamin Arditi, it seems to me then that corruption, coupled with the economic dislocations that neoliberalism can produce, and then add to that COVID, sort of at the core of all of this is the responsiveness of the government to the needs of the population. Is that pretty consistent that then would contribute to the rise of these outsider political parties, outsider political figures?
It's not only corruption, it's also the Siamese twin of corruption, which is impunity. Because corruption is endemic, as Maxwell already said. The thing is, you do something about corruption, yes or no? You know, in the Marxist tradition, there's a metaphor that has been used very often, which is that we're in a train of history and the locomotive of history is taking us to the promised land. Now, Walter Benjamin in 1939, 1940, turned around that metaphor saying, well, maybe sometimes the only sane thing to do is pull the emergency brakes of the locomotive of history, because if it's, instead of taking us to an utopia, it's taking us to the abyss. Now, my interpretation of why Andrés Manuel López Obrador won in Mexico is because he wanted to pull the emergency brakes of the locomotive of the Mexican system that was going, thanks to corruption and impunity, it was taking us towards a failed state. Now, all the changes that this man is doing, remember, there's quite a debate whether López Obrador and some other of these people are true leftists or not true leftists. I'm less concerned about the semantics about the issue, but what he's trying to do, and what he's trying to do is an ethical or moral refoundation of the state in order to, not to eliminate corruption, as he says, but at least to hold those accountable for corruption to some kind of punishment, which is what people are wanting to see. The interesting thing is that for somebody that is seen by The Economist and some of the commentators of the BBC or the Washington Post as a leftist, he's doing all the changes through institutional channels and without disrupting the market. Then the central bank is still independent. The Mexican peso is floating against foreign currencies. He's not even doing the basic thing that he should have done, which is a fiscal reform in order to fund all his social policies. Now, he's doing great things, like, for example, a universal pension for old age people. Anybody of the age of 65 can register to receive, regardless of their income, or can register to receive an amount of $75 per month per life without any justification. Now, the opposition says that this is a clientelistic policy. Perhaps it is, but it's presented in the language of rights. You have the right, a statutory right, to receive this money for the fact that you exist and you're over 65. The same thing is happening with young kids in order to avoid school desertion, some minimal help, and in the case of women that are heads of households. Now, if you want to call those things left-wing, I'm happy to accept that. But basically, it's just decency. It's just the assumption that a country with such level of inequality is a time bomb ticking, ready to go off.
And Garcia Rivero Diaz, corruption has been a significant issue in Brazilian politics, and certainly the PT has been ensnared in some of these issues. How significant does this issue look like it's going to play in the upcoming election?
The biggest problem is the perception of corruption in Brazil. And these scandals that we had in Brazil since 2006 and involving the social democrat government, delusion. Most people about this kind of politics and the price of these politics. But this moment, the economic problem becoming worse because of the war in Europe, and we have problems of inflation and the pandemic and many things. Now we have confront between two forces. One with the politics of reduction of state and economic restriction. At this moment, we have a larger discussion about Petrobras, the largest public enterprise of petroleum in Brazil. And we have the confront of two visions, one vision more social democrat and another with a neoliberal vision, but with a kind of conservatism, cultural conservatism. So we believe at this moment that we will have a chance to the pink version of the politics and the return of social democrat politics. But we don't know how this new government will deal with the situation of corruption. And because, as Max commented before, this is endemic in Latin America. And it's not was born in Lula's government or PT government, but highlights at this time. So we have many things to observe since a new government started.
Max Kelly, you had a response.
Yeah, if, you know, one of the things that makes me a little bit uncomfortable about the debate on corruption is that it's very easy to identify this as a key sort of governance issue. And that's particularly true for governments in the North, like my own in Canada or the United States, where we oftentimes act as if the challenges of strengthening governance in countries in the Western Hemisphere is really a challenge of eliminating corruption. So Canada, for example, has a proposal to have an international court on corruption, as if we could, the idea seems to be if we could get rid of corruption, then we would have solved a major governance issue. And that what that doesn't acknowledge, first of all, are some of the reasons for corruption, how they're rooted historically in inequality and in weak states, and then the need to reinforce the capacity of public institutions to respond to the demands of the people. And that what that requires is that when we see change happening, when we see things like the election of somebody like Gustavo Petro in Colombia or Boric in Chile, our first reaction shouldn't be, gosh, what does this mean for Canadian mining companies, right? What does this mean for Canadian banks and Canadian businesses? And that we're alarmed by the processes of social transformation. They're actually critical to the construction of better governance. And if we dealt with issues, for example, as I think Ben rightly said, the issue of impunity, this would be a very serious problem for Canadian mining companies in the region. So there's a little bit of hypocrisy in the way in which we approach this discussion of corruption. And I'd like to see us complement a concern for corruption with a concern for, as Ben said, impunity, but also the ways in which different branches of government often encroach on one another. Guillermo O'Donnell made this wonderful argument that we focus a lot of attention on corruption. We don't focus quite so much on encroachment, the ways in which, for example, executives can act against the independence of courts. And actually, if we think about Brazil, you know, one of the things that the Lula government did was to try to empower the capacity of the judiciary to investigate corruption in the public sector. And ironically, you know, the Lula and Dilma became victims of that very growth in the activism on the part of the courts. Not a bad thing to have that kind of accountability in place, but there are also some risks associated with it. It's finding ways of balancing these institutions. I think it is much more important, frankly, it's not more important, but it's equally important and it's connected to the problem of corruption.
And Benjamin Arditi, I'm going to give you the last word on this question about, again, making the government responsive, making it responsible, and you know, questions of impunity. Is there hope in the region that we're going to see lifting the veil of some of this impunity?
Of course, there's hope. There's always hope. I believe in the bottle of whiskey being half full, not half empty. My first element of hope is that I'm surprised that Boric, Petro, and López Obrador were sort of outsiders, even though López Obrador was a career politician for 30, 40 years. But they were seen as an anti-system, all of these as anti-system candidates. But the funny thing is that the democratic procedures for the replacement of government worked perfectly. Nobody complained. Well, there were complaints, as always. But it's surprising that our biggest example of the greatest democracy in the Western Hemisphere being the U.S., you're still fighting about what were the official results of the 2020 elections. Now, that for me, it's surprising that given that these are outsiders, people that are questioning the system, everybody accepted the rules of the game, and it worked so far, at least. There was no coup, no movement of sabers. The only case of a similar to a coup is the downfall of Evo Morales in Bolivia a couple of years ago. That I would definitely call a right-wing coup, even though there's lots of polemic about it. So do we have to be hopeful? If we're not hopeful, we should commit suicide and stop thinking about changing the world. It's the only thing that I could say about this.
No, absolutely. And I think it's a strong case for hope in the region, and actually a strong case for these positive developments, whether it's the first leftist president in Colombia, which, as far as I'm concerned, means that democracy in Colombia is flourishing, you know, in ways that it hadn't, the empowerment of these different communities. And I'm hoping building a more responsive government throughout the region. And for the record, hoping my own government, the United States, might learn a bit about this and become a bit more responsive. We've been discussing the so-called pink wave, or the success of leftist presidential candidates throughout Latin America. Our guests today have been Benjamin Arditi, professor of politics at the National University of Mexico. He is the author of Politics on the Edges of Liberalism, Difference, Populism, Revolution, Agitation, and Arguments About the Left Turns in Latin America, a Post-Liberal Politics. Maxwell Cameron, professor of political science and public policy and global affairs at the University of British Columbia. He is the co-editor of Latin America's Left Turns, Politics, Policies, and Trajectories of Change, and the author of The Return of Oligarchy, Threats to Representative Democracy in Latin America. And Marcia Ribeiro Diaz, adjunct professor and researcher in political science at the Federal University of the State of Rio de Janeiro. Her current research project is on disillusionment and the art of silence, a study in electoral abstention in Brazil, and the co-author of The Mutualism Between Liberal Conservatism and Fascism, Ideological Dispute and the Political Scenario of Contemporary Brazil. Thank you all very much for joining us. I'd like to give a special thanks to the Scholar Circle team, Maria Armudian, host and anchor, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers. Sud Dongri, webmaster and production assistant. All Scholar Circle shows are archived on scholarcircle.org. You can find our podcast on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle Twitter account, and please join our Facebook page. On behalf of the Scholar Circle team, I am Doug Becker. Thank you for listening.